Today is Monday, April 10th, 2023. This is part 4 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Scott Imsland. Scott spells his last name I-M-S-L-A-N-D. And my name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Scott. How are you today?
Yeah, all is well. It's a beautiful day out here on the coast.
Nice.
It's gorgeous.
Great.
Yeah, winter is past now, so it's really fun.
Okay. Got some flowers out there.
Oh God, the flowers are going crazy. The fruit trees are going crazy.
Oh my gosh,
our home of bees is going crazy. So we're totally in spring right now.
Nice.
Completely
nice.
It's nice.
May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. Give us some business here. Last time we left off, you were traveling south to Marble Canyon for your first Grand Canyon River trip. I think that was 1971, though it sounds like I may be wrong. And can you pick that story up, please?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I always thought in my memory that I had come to the Grand in 72. But as we backtrack on our years, Tom Martin feels like it could have been 71. So, see, the 71 and 72, and I flew after the being with the archery hunting guide in Idaho before I left Idaho for Arizona. I had enough money to get a bus ticket to Boise, and from Boise, I flew. Art was good enough to give me an airline ticket to go from there to Salt Lake City,
okay.
And then Salt Lake City. When I landed there, I had met a Mormon lady that asked what I was up to, and I told her I was going down to Grand Canyon, and she says, well, I'll take you over to my house, and I'll give you some lunch. And then I asked if she couldn't drop me off at a good spot to hitchhike to get down farther south, and that's how that worked out.
That's
so she
nice.
Dropped me off.
Well, nice for
really
she. That's lovely.
Yeah. And so because of that, as far as Mormons, I've always been kind in thoughts of the Mormons because they were she was super helpful.
Nice.
And very nice. So that got me down. And then after I got down into that area, I probably hitchhiked a little bit more because the trucker or whoever I got a ride with could only go a certain way. But I kept getting closer and closer to Lee's Ferry, and I remember going over to Hatch's warehouse and so forth, and they probably gave me a ride further to either Lee's Ferry, where I met the Arda group, or it was actually in Baderville, and kind of north Flagstaff is where our warehouse was for Arda. So somehow I know that the Hatch warehouse had something to do with me finally getting down there after the, up in northern Idaho in a day. Now I'm nearly at Lee's Ferry, or I'm at the warehouse of Arda. But that's where the whole beginning began, and that was going to be the start, helping rig up the following day after my arrival and taking the boats up to Lee's Ferry and rigging everything, getting used to what the scene was for river trips in Grand Canyon.
Okay.
And that brought me there.
Who did you meet on that trip? Do you remember who was guiding on that trip? Who'd you go with?
Peter Wynn, who later was a ranger for the Park Service there. But Peter and I had done a lot of river trips together, and I knew a lot of the other folks on that trip from California work, maybe some Idaho work. And Gary Dubois was also on that trip.
This is your friend Gary from Sacramento.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, he was on that. He was guiding for Arda in Grand Canyon. So kind of Gary and I.
It's like old home week there.
Oh, totally. It was like all of the all these people. In fact, when I was just looking through some Stanislaus pictures, and I'm looking at people that actually followed my tracks to where I got, not because of me, but it was like the way things worked. You worked in Oregon, you worked in on the Stanislaus, you worked on the South Fork American, and from there, I guess as you matured or whatever, I don't know, whatever management decided, but all that group kind of finally migrated to Grand Canyon, and Rob Elliott had asked me prior to a couple of after Idaho seasons, and had asked me to go to Grand Canyon, and I was too tired to go and do anything in Grand Canyon for a couple of months at the end of summer. But I finally agreed to do that. So that brought me to Flagstaff and Arda, and Gary Dubois was on that trip. Pete Wynn, I had done my first actually commercial trip with some college friends of his that he paid me for, and we always recognize that as, oh, that's my first time getting paid to do river running.
Was that on the Salmon or the Middle
No,
Fork?
That was on Stanislaus.
Okay.
I believe that was Stanislaus.
All right.
And so he was on the trip, and he was basically the fellow that I hung with amongst. There was Gary and Peter and Jerry Jordan, a great guitar banjo player that I did a lot of trips with in Grand Canyon. He added a lot of music, and he was a great personality out of Alabama. Great, great man. And his sister, Suzanne Jordan, also was not on that trip, but she eventually was able to get on as a guide with Arda, which probably by then was Azra. But Jerry Jordan was a big presence on any river trip, and Suzanne, the sister, was also just a super friendly, just as you can imagine, a lady from the South and the accent and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So Jerry was on it, and then a guy named Gary Kelly, which was there with...
How do you spell Gary's last name?
I imagine it's K-E-L-L-E-Y, Kelly.
Okay.
Gary Kelly. And in this story, presently, he will come up again.
Okay.
And let's see, who else? Michael Wynn, Peter's brother, was on that trip. Michael Wynn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's about all I can really recollect that were there. No women, and so that was the start. And we got to Lee's Ferry, and we put all the boats together. And at that time, we were rowing experimental snout rigs that became permanent. They worked really well. They were a size that handled the Grand really well. And at that time, nobody knew what was the proper rowing boat to go down there on the Grand Canyon. And there was lots of commercial debate about, you know, rowing trips. It's more ecological. We should be rowing these things. So that put pressure on Park Service. Should we go to motors out of the picture, only rowing? So people are trying how to get rowing boats, but to make it economically satisfying for the owners. They were going up to bigger boats and other ideas, and then probably politically trying to, like, fight any change. Keep the motors, keep the rowing trips, we'll all get along, and don't disrupt the economy of river rafting. So that was all going on right then. And so we were on snout rigs rowing, and they also, of which I rowed quite a bit on my early months there, was what we called shorty pontoons that were 28-foot, rafts without a floor. They were all this is military World War II or Korean War equipment. And so if you can imagine, as we found out that the snout rigs, which were in the 20s,
22 feet
length,
right?
Yeah, 22, something like that.
Yeah.
And then they were finding that these boats worked well. And the shorty pontoons were just like elephant to row. I mean, and they, in fact, figure that was going to happen, so they put in two rowing positions on that boat so that two guys would be running one boat instead of one guy. But it turned out that if you were game for it to row that big boat by yourself, that would put another boatman somewhere else and maybe save them money. But it was fine. I didn't mind rowing that big rig, and it was really, you know, the canyon waterway was much bigger than Idaho in general, unless it was flood. But Grand Canyon was big, and it was kind of comfortable to have these snout rigs and shorty pontoons.
Okay.
The
22-foot snout rig, well, I'm just going to call it 22 just to differentiate it from the shorty pontoon, the 28-foot shorty pontoon,
yeah.
Which shorty at 28 feet sounds kind of ridiculous, but there you go. How many people would you normally get on the 22-foot snout rig?
That was generally like six people were on that.
So five passengers and a rower and a crew member?
Six passengers and a rower.
Okay.
And that seemed to be pretty standard. And the shorties had a few more people, I think, on that. But, I mean, the thing was a barge to begin with.
Right.
I think. And that didn't, I don't recollect that lasted too long just because it was so big and heavy, and nobody wanted to break their back rowing those boats. And there were oars that were ordered that were, or they were military. We had a lot of, everything was military. But the oar lengths that it took to run those big boats was, you know, they were really long. I couldn't tell you the footage of them, but it's not like rowing Avon six-man boat or anything modern now. These things are huge. Everything about it was huge.
Hmm. Okay.
Boat-wise, gear-wise, everything was big. So, so we started down, so I'm floating down, and the thing that I noticed most of all was how hot it was, and I was used to being in the mountains up in high elevations and cold mornings, cold water, snow on the ground if we started early in the season. And here I am down in Grand Canyon, and it was just unbelievably hot compared. And I came from a lot of moisture, trees, waterfalls, on and on. And it was, you know, compared to Grand Canyon, which was just dry, treeless.
Yeah.
And animals, no animals. Burros were the only animals generally. And being in the Grand for the first time was very, it was amazing. It was an environment and all these rock walls and all this geology. And it was pretty overwhelming in an exciting way. It was just like a whole nother experience. It's like I'd been transported into the Wizard of Oz all this stuff. It was just crazy. For me, coming from, you know, the flooding Middle Forks and the flooding Selways, and now I'm in the Grand Canyon in these huge boats with pretty placid water until you got to rapids, and you're just floating along. And then as the time goes on, you find that the Grand Canyon has some pretty strong winds, and you got to row against all that. And there's fluctuations in the river levels all the time, and you got to learn that. And then learn all the rapids at all those different water levels. So the Grand was, very exciting, challenging, and completely different. And so it was all really a good experience. So I just sat there in the rowing seat and had Peter or Jerry or other guys that were on it, you know, tell me we're going up to 24.5 mile rapid, or this is Badger, or here's House Rock. And, you're going to watch out for this over there. And so I was just rowing through all these things on these huge boats. And the guides would just tell me what to look out for. And at low water, it's this way and blah, blah, blah. So it was, and then the camping, everything was on fire. So we had to gather wood. And finding wood was a whole art unto itself. And any wood that was around was strictly there because of pre-dam times and floods, and anything that came down Little Colorado would lay down timber and logs or whatever. And it was a real art to, like, keep that whole campfire thing and cooking thing together with wood, because it was slowly getting diminished, and we still just cooked on open fires.
Right.
And that was very, actually, in Idaho, and that was all on, we all cooked on fires there still too. So, you know, it's wild looking back that we had so much, we had all the food and all this other stuff and all this gear, but really if we never found wood, we couldn't cook any of it.
Right.
And it was not being replenished, and it was diminishing, and people knew where the little stashes were. And that was, it was pretty interesting. I'd see the Dory trips eventually go by, and they all had Coleman stoves, and they had a cook on the trip, and people did dishes. And I go, God, those guys are way more modern. We're like way back in time, building fires, gathering wood, and cooking on fires, getting used to being able to cook chicken or spaghetti or anything on a fire successfully. But all that was done for me up in Idaho, so it wasn't different. It was just, I was interesting in this big scene in Grand Canyon, and we were really kind of ancient in a way. It was all just a learning process, is how it looked at to me. I was learning, but everybody was learning hikes could be.
Let's take these things one at a time. Let's start with the winds.
The winds.
Yeah. Terrible. What do you remember about the winds? I mean, and you're for people who don't know how high your rowing seat is above the water on a snout. Can you kind of describe that and why that makes a difference when the wind blows?
I was on snout rigs, and the seat was probably, and I modified, when I worked for M&A, I had modified my seat, so I had some changes I personally made to my boat. And I would say off of the water level, we were maybe at least 6 feet between, probably not 7 feet, but 6 feet above the water. And the oars were quite long, necessarily, because the boat was out of the water, your seat was out of the water, and the tubes were big on a snout rig.
And their boat's fairly wide, so it's probably, 8 feet wide or more?
Yeah, probably 6 or 7 feet wide.
Okay.
And so to get your oars, and we've talked about thole pins and oarlocks some, but they were all on thole pins.
Okay.
And so you had to get from your hand, from the seat of the boat, out past the tubes of the boat, and into the water where you could make a purchase with the blade of the oar. So
14 feet, maybe? Something like that?
A 14? As far as the oar length you're talking about? Yeah, I would say at least that.
Okay,
least
14, 16? Okay.
Yeah.
Were they counterweighted? Did they have some sort of metal on them by the handle?
Some of the guides later on... I never was interested in doing that. They were wrapped lead around the handle area there and counterbalanced it all, but I had no interest in that, and I didn't think it was a particularly successful thing for people to do. But people, male and females, did that, and it helped, I suppose. But man, when you're rowing in Grand Canyon on these boats, you are so strong that there's no way you aren't just Herculean when you're done.
Yeah.
You do a season, you're tough, you're tanned, dark, you're just really, it was a lot of work. Everything was work. And on the beaches, bringing water up for cooking and for washing and everything is like unloading the boats, getting the food containers up and down the bench of sand. So waiting an oar, you were so strong after you started growing. Give me a break, man. You're just going to get clobbered with the end of that oar when you get it jammed into a wall or it gets pulled out of your hands. It's going to hit a passenger in the head. Everything is very, very dynamic, let's say, down there, or any river trips that you're running or rowing on.
Yeah, so thinking of the winds, you're sitting up quite high, and you were sitting up much higher than you were on the boats in Oregon, which are more down lower quite a bit.
Yeah, they were normal. You know,
right, normal raft.
What you would, just the typical rafts, you know, that whitewater people run now, basically.
Right.
Except there were no self-bailing floors ever, so your boat always had to be bailed, except for the snout rigs, and the shorty pontoons, you know, had just frames dropped down from chains, and so the wind was like, if you take a snout rig, it had a nice bow on it. That was really good for the rapids because you could plunge through a lot of stuff, and it was quite well designed. And but the wind, if it was an upstream wind, would catch all of that front end of your boat, which is sticking up in the air at like a 45 degrees. So the wind, sometimes there were times in my life there that It was an MNA trip that we didn't get off and on the water for 3 days just because the wind was so strong.
Wow.
Motor rigs were flipping at Lee's Ferry. I mean, the wind was so strong. They would push off from Lee's Ferry with their motors and everything and just sit like mid-river fighting wind. The wind was so strong, they just couldn't get down the river. And we knew on our rowing boats, we wouldn't be going anywhere. We were watching just chaos with the wind and the gear flying around and boats getting lifted up in the air. And so the wind can be extremely intense.
Hmm.
And rowing against it's super, super difficult. And if we were on the water, there'd be times that I'd just pull over and tie off to some tamarisk or a rock or whatever. And the wind was definitely a problem. And you had to make time. So if you had a river that did not have much water flow because of the dam, and then you put wind on top of that, you had no current. And when you've got 30,000, which might be typical back in my days, 30,000 wasn't abnormal. It was kind of a nice. And you could see, you know, there's plenty of current out there. And pulling out from camp, you know, it's like the current hits you and kind of spins you, wants to spin you around. And that was really nice to have. It was always a blessing to have current, even if it added big water to everything and that sort of thing. But when you had wind and low water, it was really hard to go anywhere. So you had to make camp, and you had to make, you know, your takeout, you know, in 2 weeks, and you couldn't get behind on your distance, and you couldn't do the hikes you wanted to do because you couldn't get downriver. So the winds were just a real headache in the Grand Canyon. And then couple that with the changing of water levels and cutting off water, and you had no flow, and so you're fighting wind and no flow. So, you know, there's a lot of stuff to learn and to figure out when you get into Grand Canyon and start guiding there.
Yeah.
Run a successful trip.
Let's talk about river fluctuations for a little bit.
Sure.
What is it, 14 miles roughly upstream of Lee's Ferry is Glen Canyon Dam. Dam took over river control in the spring, early winter of 1963, January. And so here we are in, say, 71, 72, not that, you know, 9 years out or 8 years out from the dam now. What did the dam do to river flows? How did that work?
So I never got to run it without a dam, so I only knew it with a dam, and we never had any management or whatever calling up to find out what flows were going to be, and I was going to be dependent on electricity for Las Vegas and Phoenix and California or whatever, and that's what's going to determine what the flow of water is going to be. So you could the flows were erratic. They always seemed to come up for the morning, or they came up that night. During the day, I didn't notice or recollect right now that anything was changing during the day. It kind of was just stable. Whatever you woke up in the morning, if it was 20,000 or 15,000 or 25,000 or 30-some thousand, that's kind of what you were looking at. And sometimes I would sticks down in the at water and the sand for our campsite just to see if while we were doing breakfast if the river was changing, and that would help getting levels together. And if you knew that you were roughly, and that's some other thing, as you work down there, you really got to feel kind of a lot of working down there almost made you feel like a native down there, like the Indians figuring out when the storms come and what to look for and flash flooding and all that kind of stuff. You got very, very primitive in a way. You could look at the river or push your boat out or do whatever, and you could guess pretty close to what the flow was after doing it so much.
Mm-hmm.
And that was real interesting to make that. And the whole season that you're down there, I don't think anybody would disagree that you become kind of a native in being able to tell when the storms are coming, what the wind change means. If you're on a hike up a canyon, when to get out of a canyon because of flash flooding and the storms and lightning and the stuff you don't see right in front of you, but it's happening up a canyon or up on North Rim or tapping on South Rim, and you're not seeing it, but you're getting little keys as to something's changing, and we better get out of the canyon here and get down to our boats and get back on the river. And so river flows were dependent upon what the dam had to produce, what they had to produce as electricity, and maybe requirements for water flow to various cities. But as electricity, and the change would basically happen during the evening time. You wake up to a new flow, and you'd have to, with your campsites and your rigging of your boats and where you tie off, all that had to be learned so that you didn't have the water drop during the night or in the morning and leave your boat up on a pyramid of rock,
right,
or stuck in between, and you're your own island amongst a bunch of big, huge boulders, and then you got to deal with how you're going to get your boat out from that or wait for high water to come and lift you out. And there's a lot going on with that dam that made you be, you know, kind of more of a boatman down there, because you had so many different things going on all the time. Hmm. And the dam was a part of it, and that was the flow that you were going to run on for that day. And
right. So let me make sure I understand this. The dam had the potential to crank up to, what, 32 or 35,000?
Yeah. I'd say 32 was the standard.
And would drop down to what at night? Do you remember?
I would say it would drop down into the, it could be in the late teens and early 20s. And we would think that 15,000 was definitely low. And then you'd have to think about what your rapid enhance was going to look like, or what was crystal going to look like, or what was house rock going to look like, or is it so low that Badger, you know, sometimes becomes kind of unrunnable when it's really low. Just a lot of interesting stuff. When the water drops, you're dealing with rapids, your boat getting stuck behind and on cliffs. Lots of stuff happens when you're not aware of what the river is really doing. And I've seen a lot of boats just in the wrong place. They just weren't thinking or didn't know or were amateurs or whatever. But, yeah, flow created a lot of problems.
Okay. And that would happen every day. Water would go up, water would go down. So as you got further away from the dam and further into the canyon, you would get out of sync with the dam. So in the morning you'd wake up and the water was dropping. If you move further away from the dam, you'd wake up and the water was rising because you'd be back in sync again.
Very true.
And the further away from the dam you went, the up and down would decrease. So it would kind of temper out a little bit. Still go up and down, but not as much as closer to the dam.
Yeah, true. And I believe you would sort of, as you got farther and farther down and you were noticing that the flows were changing, you would just kind of interpret, you know, okay, we're this far away from the dam, and the flow did come up, so maybe the whole trip, 3 weeks you're out there, you get an idea of what the releases are, and you're right, it takes a while to get water from the dam to you, which was a curious a moment when the 83 floods came and we were trying to find safe places in case the dam broke or whatever. The thinking about the distance, how fast could water, if the dam broke, how fast, how much time do we have before it hits us? We're this far from the dam and it's moving, let's just say, at 30 miles an hour or something like that, because it's the current now is changing with a dam release. The dam's broken. We'd get a hit. Probably, I presume, a helicopter would have come and said the dam is broken and you need to get to high ground or whatever. But there were, during those big water years or month or week, that was definitely a part of what you were thinking about, was where was the dam? How far from it? Are we in a safe spot? Will we have to evacuate? Blah, blah, blah. So that dam.
Right, and let's hold 83 until we get there, because this is sort of 70, early 70s. where it's just the great yo-yo. It goes up, it goes down, it goes up, it goes down. It happens every day, and that was just life. And there wasn't any thought of structural failure, because that kind of hadn't gotten, well,
very true.
People might worry about it, you know, gee, there's a dam up there. Wonder what happens when if. But there wasn't anything you had to deal with, because the next day the water dropped or the water would come up.
True.
It sounds like when you broke camp in the morning and you pushed away from shore, you would basically move with that water at that time. It might go faster than you, so it would if it was rising, you would rise. If it was dropping, it would drop out from under the trip during the day as you moved along.
Yeah, that's possible. I don't remember. I don't remember that as an issue.
Okay.
Through the day, it dropping, or it's going to do this, or whatever. I don't recollect so much that being an issue. The issue was pulling into camp and making sure you had a mooring that was safe and the boats weren't in a bad position, which does happen. So.
So let me think about this for a minute. A 22-foot rowing snout,
mm-hmm.
or one of the shorties, pulling into camp. Talk about that.
Pulling into camp on those big boats, you are, for one thing, you're strong at this point. So the physicality of it is somewhat taken care of. But really diving into the top of eddies and stuffing that boat in at a great angle that knifes across a powerful eddy, and you get into the eddy. Maybe there's some boulders that are at the top of your campsite there, and the river's pushing around it, and there's an eddy behind it. So you're always kind of managing your hiking canyon sites and your campsites and how you get a heavy boat that is not, it's a cumbersome boat. It does its job really well, but it's a real animal, and you can't fight it because the current, the river, and the boats are too powerfully involved in this. So you've got to know what you're doing, and you have to be an artist at how to handle your boat and not go round and around in big eddies that are like a Granite Rapid, and you know, after you leave Phantom Ranch, there's some really bad eddies, and you put these heavy boats in a bad eddy that you can't break the eddy fence. You are exhausting yourself going round and around like football fields of rowing, and you're trying to get at the top and break through that, and you can't break through the eddy fence. So putting your boat into camp or at Els Chasm or Havasu or any of these places, you always, Olo, you had to knife your boat, come in stern first, and with a lot of power, come in as high up in that eddy as you could possibly get without hitting the wall or hitting a boulder right there. You're really like dumping it right into the perfect spot to break across the eddy fence at the very top, and now you get locked completely in that eddy. And from that point, you're stable. And if there happens to be a beach you're going to, or a wall that rope is, you know, got to wrap around a rock or whatever is going to happen. But you got to, in order to get your boat to camp, to a canyon, out of a canyon, in a position to help somebody that's got a problem, you've got to read water well, understand your boat. You'll have the strength to do it, and you'll get worn out if your intelligence of how to run a boat, what to watch out for, current, rapids, eddy fences, all that. If you don't understand that, you're just going to be frustrated, and it's right. not going to happen for you. You probably won't end up being hired as a guide. So there's a lot to learn just about that. And breaking the top of an eddy into that, through that eddy fence with the stern, and you're rowing and powering with your back to where you need to be, and once you cross over and it glides past that fast-moving eddy fence, then you're pretty much done. You know, you might go around that eddy a little bit, but at least you're in it, and
right.
and ferry yourself and use your oars to hold you in it, And then maybe throw, maybe a, an assistant is behind you and has a stern line and can throw it to somebody. But I prefer not to get a rope off the boat into the water. So you just do good a job of putting your boat where you need to put it.
Right. And that all would have been a little different from what you were doing on in the Pacific Northwest.
In a way, yes. But like I on the previous part of our recordings, the floods that we ran in were very similar to Grand Canyon.
Got it.
And even
okay.
more brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah, they were brutal. Yeah, that was tough.
Okay, that's right. Well, that, so that would have been very good experience, very good practice, if you will.
And the reason is because the Grand Canyon only has a few feet of drop per mile, and the Idaho or other mountain rivers, they could have 12 feet of drop. They could have 15 or 20 feet of drop.
Okay.
And so you're drilling a really fast water on when they're flooding in the mountains. So you learn a lot right there.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. That makes sense. Okay. And so I'm really fascinated with the slowly diminishing supplies to cook food. And you know, the beaches were really getting despoiled by 71. It was marked in the 60s, actually. People were going to the bathroom, toilet papers here and there, you know, lots of fire pits. Everybody was cooking on, and the dam, there was no high water anymore to wash all that stuff downstream to the next reservoir out the other side of Grand Canyon and into Lake Mead above Hoover Dam.
Yeah, absolutely. The cooking and how everybody disposed of, like, there'd be a bucket where the dinner or the breakfast or whatever, it would throw it into a white bucket or a baling bucket or whatever, put it in there, and then crawl up on the rocks, and they were calling it like casting. You go up and cast all of that garbage up away from camp up in the rocks. And that's how you got rid of it. We didn't even think about hauling it off the river at that time. And that goes to the bathrooms up down there. And there was a chemical porta potty. And that chemical porta potty didn't get hauled off the river. You dug a hole in these campsites that have had too many, you know, motor rigs and now ore rigs, but the motor rigs could carry all these people. I mean, they had tons of people on their boats. We only had six in boatmen, and they would come to a beach and with maybe 20, 25 plus people, set up the bathroom and then go dig a hole and dump it all, the chemical, the poop and everything. And at that time, I don't even think the idea of peeing in the river was going on. And so that was, you know, it was a really a monumental change to have the porta potty system that everybody finally came to, because you could come to a camp and it was so foul with charcoal, fires on the beaches, the porta potty just 15 feet away from all the cooking's going on. And I remember, and this is a story, if you want me to go with a Western rig, and I had I was at Els Chasm. This was on an M&A science trip, and one of the people that was helping, one of the biologists, wasn't very coordinated, and he crashed his head at Els into a rock, so I had to evacuate him. And I luckily, in modification of my snout rig, I had made it so there was a transom on the back of it so I could mount a motor if I ever needed it at any time. And I also adjusted where my seat height should be. So after he hit his head, there was a motor rig commercial trip at Elves, and they gave me their spare motor, and I was able to mount it on my snout rig. And I was going to go all the way down to Havasu so I could get a phone to call out. There are no communications at that time. Radios never worked, never charged. They were wet or whatever. But so I was headed down to Havasu. And at Deer Creek, I'd made it from Elves to Deer Creek pretty successfully. with everything, going to whatever the rapids were through there. And so I pulled into Western, and they waved me over, as I recollect, and they said, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Well, I have a passenger that's injured up at Elves, and I need to get a call out." And they said, "Stay at our camp tonight." And this is now, we're in the evening. I'm getting that boat down the canyon, and it's not dark yet, but it's dusk.
Okay.
And they said, don't go any farther. Stay here. And we've got a flyover, because they had a Gene Shoemaker of, the famous...
astronomer.
Yeah. He was on that trip. And when I worked at M&A, I got to also meet all these heavy cats that were astronomers, fossil people, on and on. But he was on the trip along with some of the scientists. And they said, "Now spend the night with us." And then a man that was a boatman on that motor rig for Western came up to me in, away from the cooking area and fire area. And he said, I really don't want you." This was just amazingly, like, to me, it was just like, wow, what he had to say. And he says, "I knew Scotty that drowned at Upset, where that pie pan or whatever may still be up there, or whatever. I think that was Scotty.
Shorty Burton.
Shorty Burton. He said, I don't want you to go down. I don't want to see you go down. It's late. We can do the phone call in the morning, because we have a flyover with all that stuff. And we order the trip with all professional scientists and Gene Shoemaker." And this boatman came to me and said, "I don't want you to go down. I don't want to see you leave here. It's not going to be safe." And I watched Shorty drown or die, however he was killed.
Okay.
He was a friend of mine, and I was present, or it was a part of his life on the river right then, and watched it all happen. And he said, "I don't want to see you leave this campsite." And I go through what I watched with Shorty. And I was like, I mean, he said it was so, it was almost tearful, and I go, "Okay, I'm going to stay. I'll stay. And you promised me that there'll be a flyover?" He says, "Yep, every morning, 7 o'clock, flyover happens." I said, "Okay, I'll do it." And then they opened up the bar, and we partied the whole night long. And that was really, really fun to be with all those guys and talking about it. And so then in the morning came, and the flyover came, got the helicopter scheduled, and my job was done at that point. And I watched, and this gets back to the porta potty stuff, and I watched, I'd never been on a campsite with a motor rig of a lot of people, and I'd camped at that site across from Deer Park, the falls, Deer Creek Falls. I'd camped there, and I watched them dig holes in the sand and dump all that effluent.
The blue goo.
God, it was terrible. I saw that and I go, "Oh my God, that's what, we probably set up our commissary there," and didn't know. And
so they were digging holes.
Yeah.
People were shitting in these containers of blue goo, and then they would dig a hole and pour that stuff into the sand and then cover it up with sand.
Yeah, that's basically, yeah. And they would, I think they were confident enough to, like, move it exactly away from where their cooking was, or where their next time they camped there would be.
Right.
They were at least thinking about, I feel like they were thinking about that, but man, it was disgusting. We did greater measures with our effluent than they were doing, and they were doing what they thought was normal. It was normal.
Right.
So anyway, then the helicopter, the plane came. I said goodbye to all those folks. We pumped my boat up. Or actually, I said, I'm just going to wait here. If the helicopter lands and has the trip started again, I'm going to stay here at Deer Creek. So that's what I did. Their trip left, and I waited. And the instructions that I had for the boatman and the people to watch our friend that had hit his head and put a big gash in it. He was all bloody and acting real goofy. He was kind of out of himself. Mm. And so I said, "Don't let him go to sleep tonight. Just somebody stay with him and keep nudging him to keep him awake and talk to him." And the helicopter, I will make that contact, and the helicopter, don't you guys go anywhere, and the helicopter will come. And I might have even said, now, if it looks like he can't figure out a place to land the helicopter downstream from the canyon, do whatever, I mean, be ready, have everything packed up and ready to go when the helicopter comes. If he has to change where he lands, be ready to move, and they could drop messages. And we had that during the floods. We got messages from the helicopters.
So I'm a little confused here. Your injured fellow was transferred to the Western trip to go to Havasu?
No. Not at all.
Your injured guy stayed with you, and...
No, he stayed with the crew that I was taking down the canyon.
Oh, so your injured guy is not with you at Deer Creek. He's back up there with your crew at Els Chasm.
Exactly.
Got it.
That was the safest thing to do, was to leave him with these folks, a medical kit, and instructions to keep him awake as much as you can. Talk to him.
Right.
You know, check on him. Be be with him.
Yeah.
And you'll do what you have to do. And then I left him. And then we got the motor from the motor rig onto my boat.
Right.
We got gas.
Okay. So you're down there at Deer Creek, and you get the word out. A helicopter needs to go to Elves. So then you're just going to wait there until your trip shows up. I got it. Okay.
Yeah. That's right. And the message up to the helicopter was that there's an injury just below Els Chasm. Go up there. You'll see him. And the man has to be evacuated. He had a head injury. And that's about it. That's what you got to do. And so that's what happened. The helicopter found a place to land, and they hauled him out. Our guys were rigged and ready to go when that was finished. And then they joined me down at Deer Creek.
Got it.
And I asked him, so how did it go? And how was, I don't remember the guy's name, but how was he? And he says, yeah, he did good. We stayed with him, and we kept him amused and alive and so forth, and we watched him. And so he was gone. And oddly enough, later on the trip, the doctors released him because we had a few more weeks to go, and they released him to come back, and I believe he either came down in a helicopter or he was on another boat somehow that was going down. But however it was, he joined us eventually, and they said his injury was he didn't have a concussion. He was together enough that I think I told him, no, I'm not going to take him back. But we ended up taking him, finishing the trip with him. But
got it. That's not the 71. Your first trip, that was a later trip.
No.
Got it. Okay.
No,
got it. Yeah.
Now I'm with M&A, and that's...
Okay.
We'll
get there. Yeah.
So I just wanted to bring that up because the porta potty thing was, and how I got to a Western group with the porta potty.
Okay.
That's where all that came from.
All right. So not knowing that on your first trip in 71, was it men downstream, women upstream? Here's a roll of toilet paper. And there's the river. If you're thirsty, here's a cup. How did that work out?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's the way it worked in Idaho. There's a military collapsible shovel with toilet paper on top, and go and dig a hole, and here's a bag for the toilet paper, and we'll put it in the fire and burn it off, and on we go. And in Grand Canyon, it was, I think we might have pointed people, like, you know, the men, women downstream and all that, that occurred. And we might have pointed out places for them to poop, I think everybody kind of like took care of themselves. I mean, it was not like rules and regulations, because it was a uncompromising situation, however you looked at it. It was terrible. Mm. It was so negligent. But that's the way it was. It was kind of free form.
So you mentioned the casting, just basically, you know, dumping the trash up in a rock somewhere. Did you get into the days of putting your trash in burlap bags for deposit at Phantom?
No, That never happened.
All right.
No.
All right.
I don't even know. I'd never even heard of that, actually.
Okay, fine. Because it happened for a while. And then the park was like, no, we're not doing this anymore. But that's a that's neither here nor there. I just wondered if that was something that happened.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
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 And I always wondered, like, this Grand Canyon is, and see, in Idaho, on the Middle Fork, there were intermittent outhouses. Not every place had an outhouse, but I was surprised. Go, wow, they got outhouses on these beaches that everybody uses. That's smart. And then in the Grand Canyon, I'm going, God, how many thousand people go down the canyon? Hmm. I mean, this place is commercial. This is not remote like my Idaho stuff. This is commercial running, and they don't have any porta potties at these campsites that everybody uses.
Right.
And you fly a helicopter down and you pull the trash out and off we go. But that never happened in Grand Canyon. It went right to putting it in the ammo cans and whatever and hauling it all off, which was good.
Right. They tried it. It was short-lived. But, yeah, it's a fascinating story, that whole deal. But it was just a little before then when you showed up.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. But you are going to get in on the transition into the, pooping in a can. And taking that out. So, but cooking on the beach and that first 1971, 72. Did you drop anything in the river to try to get, did heavy stuff sink, cans and whatnot, that kind of stuff?
I don't know what you mean by, like, our frying pans or something.
No, if you had a can, you open up a can or something. So you got this can.
Okay.
Would the can get castered or would it get sunk?
No, we would crush it with rocks and. I think we hauled that stuff off. We didn't leave that kind of stuff. No. So when you emptied out a food container, a rocket box, when you emptied that out, that's where the crushed cans went. And any garbage that was plastic or whatever, that was never less. It was always the clippings from celery or carrots, lettuce, anything.
So all the vegetable,
rotted,
vegetable
all
matter.
The vegetable stuff.
Yeah.
That was all that was left in us. And then the... we had, because we learned in Idaho that how foul the charcoal did to the beaches there, and it just ruined the environment for customers paying to have it kind of pristine. And in Grand Canyon, it was just the Deer Creek Camp, that one with the overhang, you know, which is great in the storms, that thing was just charcoal gray, I remember, just foul, and there was never enough rain or whatever to like get in there and wash those things down.
Right.
It seemed like it just not enough high water to wash things. And I do believe that, at least I thought about when we built fires, let's do it all at least below high water mark, and at least when the river rises, it'll wash this stuff.
Yeah.
And we'd also, that was another thing, we could put in a plastic bag, was in the charcoal. When it was cold, we would put it into a plastic bag and take that out too, so we didn't leave it all there. But not everybody did stuff like that. So that's why the sandy beaches were just really, like you had mentioned, God, they were just charcoal filled, gray. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
But no, we hadn't evolved to little stove with propane yet. So.
Right. Right. Yeah. So it was going to happen, but
It happened. Yeah. But and the Dories were ahead. They did it, and I always wondered, like, why aren't we doing that? It's enough years now. We've got to evolve. And then it finally got to where the outdoor stores didn't have, like, long propane cooking outfits.
Right.
At that time, that didn't exist. And we were taking the burners off of hot water heaters, and somebody would figure out how to fashion that together so we could have a longer, so we could put, like, jugs to heat for dishwater, we could boil for noodles, we could do whatever. We could finally bring propane tanks down and hook it all up and go to town instead of worrying about where we're going to get our wood. And we don't have any wood. How are we going to cook dinner? What dinner should we do?
Right.
And that was a big problem, I thought. No wood.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the dam held it all back, all the wood.
What else do you remember about that first trip that was unusual or that you recall?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, very unusual, very enlightening, and very informative. And like I mentioned, the heat was off the charts in my mind. I was used to cold water, which Grand had cold water too, from the dam. But that first trip, get me on track with what... your line of thought was?
Yeah, just other things you remembered. It was really hot, water up and down.
Yeah, all that stuff. So and the water changing, and the rapids were big, and we got to Crystal, and at that time, I wouldn't say, you know, Crystal is changing all the time, but at least they all felt, but that could have been just out of ignorance, that they all felt like the only way to run Crystal is go down dead center, hit the sucker in the middle, hang on, and when you're rowing, you row, you know, up to your setup dead center, and then just hang on to your load or whatever, because you're going to get hit by that really deep hole and the whole rooster tail at the top. And we never flipped a boat there. I flipped later on in different parts of that Crystal, but at that time, everybody just kind of ran dead center. That surprised me. Looking back after working there, I go, God, we didn't even stop to look at it. We just headed down after Hermit, and dead center, bang.
Okay.
Blow up. You know, I knocked lenses out of two different passengers out of their glasses. Hmm. Had them hang on, get down on the bottom of the boat and hang on, and they'd get hit by that rooster tail at top. And blasted the lenses out of two different people two different times. And people, there were accidents with, I remember somebody hitting their head on part of the frame because they just got slammed. It was intense. To hit that hole and not have it open up for you, you were just like hitting a wall and throwing people around. Luckily, we never lost anybody, but there were, you know, cuts and injuries and odd stuff. That surprised me, but I go, wow, this river is powerful, man. And then I learned stuff there and all the campsites that we've talked about, what figuring that stuff out. And I was also amazed at how naive everybody was about rowing boats in the Grand Canyon, where to camp, how to cook down there, where we get clean water, what gear we bring down, on. And to have a trip start and you know, like maybe four campsites out of whatever it is, a couple hundred miles that you're going to go down. And you know a few campsites and nobody knew. And then you come back off of a trip and somebody says, oh, man, you got to go to North Canyon. We hiked in North Canyon, and we stopped there, and that's really cool. Next trip, meet people who were out, and they said, oh, Sal Canyon's really cool. There's a neat canyon up there. Or have you ever gone up here? I said, no, I didn't even know that. And says, well, Olo, you know, it's kind of a hard climb, but, God, Olo is beautiful up there. So there was lots of this coupled with, oh, we found a new campsite above Havasu. Always finding these things because it was crowded. It's getting crowded down there. Hmm. You needed to know where all these campsites were because you had to either beat a motor rig or you had to work with a motor rig or you had to beat an oar trip or you had to beat a private trip down there to a campsite because there weren't that many. And then as you work more, you found more and more campsites and you found more and more about how some might be underwater at high level. Some
right.
were fine. Some didn't work well at low water because you couldn't get close enough because of the rocks on shore. So that was amazing how little people knew of where all this stuff was down there. I was super green, but at least on the Middle Fork, not the Selway, but the Middle Fork, you know, we kind of had clues, oddly enough, of maybe other companies that, oh, there'll be a campsite on the right, look for that, you can get over there and spend the night before you go farther. But in the Grand Canyon, it was a very big learning situation. Carbon Creek Walk, all these Nankoweeb, all these places that are common stuff were not common. They were like, there were no trails up to settle. There were no, they finally came out like, you know, let's stop all this trailing, you know, let's establish one route. None of that existed.
Right.
But there were no trails anywhere. So, you know, we were kind of making stuff. And then when we got down to Lava, here I'm rowing all this stuff with Peter with me and Jerry Jordan and some other guys. And I was with Jerry on going into Lava. So now I'd rowed quite a few situations at that point in that snout rig. And we're heading in, and we looked at it. We stopped and looked at Lava. And he said, so you don't want to go by that falls. Don't ever get over in the middle on those falls. Where you want to be at this water level is we're going to go on the left-hand side, and everybody is very severely serious. This is, I wasn't at the end of my whole time there. I wasn't so angst out on lava.
Mm-hmm.
But everybody there was, we're all standing there just like if you're going over Niagara Falls or something like that. We're just all going, well, I think if we come and clip the corner of that and we can suck in and move somewhat right on that eddy behind that big pour over and on. So I'm looking at this and Jerry and we all said, okay, you got our runs down. That's where you're going to go. And just make sure you don't, when you push off, don't get anywhere close to the middle. Don't take any currents that are going to put you in the middle.
Right.
You don't want to go over those falls. And so I headed off, and a couple other people pushed off. And at the top of lava, I was aware of where I was at, and Jerry was right behind me, kind of talking to me, and this is where you're going, yeah, you're fine. The current's holding where you need to be. And then I look over, and this gets back to Gary Kelly that we talked about earlier that was on the trip, and he was on a snout rig too, and he went far right. Everybody had their own ideas of what was going to work. There was no right or wrong. It was like, I'm going to go right. I think I can do it right. And nobody had gone right, or it wasn't like, oh, you can't do that. You're an idiot, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It was like, yeah, see what happens on the right. You know, we've never been over there. Maybe there'll be a new run. And so he went over there, and I was watching, looking across the top of the falls, and he makes these big drops over there on the right side next to the lava wall,
mm-hmm.
and he flips there.
Ooh.
And he just kind of disappeared with his snout rig and just got hammered and rolled over, and I think he got stalled and then just spun over on his snout rig. And I'm here looking across the top of Lava Falls, looking at this boat stand up and flip, and all cargo, all people, everything's dumped out. And I go to Jerry. I say, man, Gary just flipped, and I think you better hop in the rowing seat. I'm not going to row this. There's going to be people all over the place. I don't know what's below this, but he just flipped. And Jerry is kind of a comical guy, and it blew his mind. Like, what? You're going to jump out of the seat right now? This is a terrible place to jump out of the seat and hand it off. And I said, man, I don't know what's going to, I don't know anything about this thing. This is huge. Water level, whatever it was big. It was, and I'd seen big water, yes, throughout the Grand Trip, but also in the other rivers. And here I was, right to, not on the edge of the falls, but that's kind of close to where we were running. And I go, man, you're going to have to do this, Jerry. You've been down this thing. You jump in and take it. And it was set up, so it wasn't a disaster when I got out. But I hopped out. He hopped kind of over me onto the seat and brought us down the left side, and it all worked out. And we spent the afternoon riding the boats and getting to shore and getting drinks out, and everybody okay, blah, blah. On and on and on.
Cool.
But that's that was a memorable piece of that trip for me.
Wow. All right.
And also we went all the way as changed. We all went all the way to South Cove. The only time we ever did it was in that era. All the way to South Cove. So I got to see the canyon way down there with the walls and tranquility.
Yeah. What would you do when the current ended? Were you still rowing? Did you row all the way to South Cove?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
We did.
Okay.
I don't remember, although there were times on private trips and with the commercials that a motorboat came up and pulled us to Pierce's Ferry.
Okay.
I don't recollect if the company got smart enough to finally get the trip off sooner. It's taken a lot of time to row to South Cove. And then the drive into South Cove across the desert, everything about it was cumbersome.
Mm.
But again, it goes back to like, there was no law or rules written for how you're going to do this. We all were learning at the same time.
Right.
And nobody was any smarter than anybody else. They might have better intuition. But so we'd go to South Cove, and that was really, looking back, was really a great opportunity to see how this canyon sort of petered out and what happened to it down lower as you went. And then along that line, is we got smarter in that Pierce Ferry had a road to it. We could go to Pierce's Ferry, or somebody decided that, and the trucks could get in on the dirt road, sandy road from highway whatever with the little town out there and the Wallapies and all that stuff. But anyway, we go to Pierce's Ferry, and then I believe there were, now let me stop there. So we'd go to Pierce's Ferry after South Cove, and then we would go, finally somebody figured out Diamond Creek. And so now the trucks could get down Diamond Creek, and finding out, well, Diamond Creek isn't the greatest place because it floods so much, and there's all sorts of wonderful calamity of the floods that all companies got involved because Diamond Creek cut off tons of distance to be able to go to the Hualapai organization, pay them a few bucks, and take the trucks down there and load. People were there, get on their bus, go to Las Vegas, wherever they're going to go. And it was way more convenient, but it didn't happen right away for that brainstorming to happen. And then all the flooding that occurred on, you know, all the floods that you would get in the canyon were coming down Diamond Creek like crazy. So we had lots of crazy thing happened with those floods and the road getting washed away. And one of the buses we had all the people in got washed away. We had to tie it off like a boat onto a tree. It was so high. The guy was driving the bus. And we probably were all in agreement. We wanted to get out of there, have beer up at home and get cleaned up. So he went for it in a big school bus. And we got bogged down in the middle of the river and got out with ropes and tied the bumpers off on each end to posts and let that river abide, quiet down. And then it was safe and we got everybody to push the bus out of the creek it was in and untie it. And we pushed it out, started. It started. Couldn't believe it. It started. We're in the middle of a river that's just howling.
Wow.
And boulders are rolling around and stuff. So, but we got it untied safely and everybody ready to push. And I wish I had movies of that. But the guys on the trip that I, you know, if we ever talk about that, would they all remember, oh, yeah, that was crazy. In a roaring river, we got a bus stuck and people are in
it. But that wasn't on the first trip. First trip ended up at South Cove.
That was farther down. Not too much, actually, but it wasn't in the beginnings. But it was in the beginnings as far as finding places to take out for the commercial trips instead of having to go. And then we also did the night floats, which is the way to do it, finally, was to get to Pierce's Ferry, hired a motorboat. They came up, and all the boats from the trip were tied together out of a big float, and that was drug out with an inboard big Chevy engined boat. And that's how we went to Pierce's, finally, and then we finally went to Diamond. So that's the story of all that.
Cool. You know what? We've been yik-yakking for over an hour here. Maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this interview series, and we will pick this up. Do you think, is there anything else in that first trip that you want to add or we can pick up next time? What are you thinking?
Yeah, that was a good, to go from the beginning to the end, that caught a lot of important stuff, some good stories. It was the naivety of everybody and the working together as a crew, and everybody just always came together. They knew what they were up against. We all knew what we were up against from stories of people coming off saying, oh man, and we had a terrible run here. Oh God. And the boats got, the valves didn't work and they were always deflating, and we hit a rock and they slit one of the tubes out, and we had to, there's so much stuff that happened on that first trip, but we got a lot of it. An awful lot of that, basically. We covered everything.
Yeah, cool.
So it was cool. Yeah.
All right. Well, with that.
And there's some good information.
Yeah, that's good. Let's go ahead and conclude part four of a Grand Canyon Oral History interview with Scott Emslin. Today is Monday, April 10th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin, and Scott, thank you so very much.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. You always take me back. It's like PTSD. I have all this drama and trauma of reliving these moments that, you know, come back to life talking to you about all this stuff. But
okay, hang on a second.